Yes, thank you. So I'm going to talk to you about hydro simulations. Mark told me I was going to give a balanced review, or he told you I was going to give a balanced review. I'm afraid I'm not going to do that. Since it's the second day we heard about it, I'm not going to go over all the ingredients of the simulations. It's too much anyway, it's too broad a topic. So I'll just give my opinion about some of the ingredients. And then present you some results at the end, the second half. I will not show you many comparisons with observations, so I apologize for that as well. I won't show you many things about Eagle, but here's one, so I just want to show you at least one aspect. So here's the density distribution in the Eagle universe from high redshift to low redshift, color-coded by temperature. And I still find it amazing that in these simulations, as well as in Illustris and in Horizon and many other simulations, there's these beautiful galaxies just popping out from some simple physical prescriptions. Well, yesterday we heard about Illustris TNG, and I'm sure we'll hear a lot more about it. So I didn't want to stay behind, so I got up early and gave you to create for you a preview of Eagle 2, for those of you who haven't seen it. So we decided to go to a much bigger volume because 100 megaparsec is really too small a volume to get good statistics. We also create light cone outputs as we go along, but we still maintain the resolution to really focus in on the galaxies and even resolve the ISM. So these were all observations except the first one. Now, I won't tell about Eagle 2 because there is no Eagle 2.
What have we been working for the last 6 months on, John?
Yeah, trying to understand the hydro solver, yeah. Okay, some starting points for to get on the same page. So I think most of you will probably agree that we do need strong outflows to reproduce observations. So that's one of the things that really led to the improvement in the hydro simulations, to make sure that there are strong outflows. There is a maximum in the stellar mass to halo mass relation, well, not stellar mass to halo mass, but the stellar mass over halo mass versus halo mass. And that maximum, we can't really reproduce without feedback processes. It's true that cooling is inefficient at massive halos, but you get horrible cooling flows and you don't really get a good maximum like is observed. So for that, I think what that tells us, we need two feedback processes. Maybe stellar AGN feedback, maybe something else, but two processes. We cannot really resolve in cosmological volumes in stellar medium. In fact, we can't even do it in zooms of Milky Way type galaxies. At least we can't resolve the molecular clouds where the star formation is happening and where the feedback starts. So I think as long as that's not the case, we can't really predict from first principles the efficiency of the feedback, with which I mean how much outflow do you generate per unit stellar mass or per unit black hole mass that you accrete. And if that's the case, then you can't really predict the stellar mass and black hole masses from first principles because they are determined by the self-regulation, accretion versus outflows. So that's unfortunate. It means we need subgrid physics for these feedback processes, and we need to calibrate them. And then to calibrate them, we need to choose what we calibrate on. So that's an important choice. You need to choose some observables that you want to get right, and which ones those are depends on the questions you're interested in. And we need to be very clear about this calibration so that we understand what we can and cannot consider to be a prediction. So there's some implications of that strategy if you use calibration, as semiotic models have done for a long time. And simulations have done as well for a long time, they just haven't been very explicit about it. So there's consequences for some of the other aspects that you might worry about. You know, the accuracy of the solver is one of them, of course. Everybody should solve the hydrodynamics and the rate of transfer and all the equations correctly. But still, it's worth keeping in mind that you might do the hydrodynamics very accurately, but then if your subgrid physics doesn't take advantage of that because you're generating the wind in a subgrid model or something, then maybe that's not as important as if you did it all correctly. Numerical convergence is another one. If you have to calibrate your simulation because you don't resolve the ISM, if you go to higher resolution and you resolve more of the ISM, then you may have to recalibrate. You should if you capture more physics, but you still don't capture all of it. So if that's the case, then you can think, you know, what about convergence? How do you demonstrate convergence with increasing resolution? And does it matter? Well, for some things it clearly does. But model selection. So for those of you who are not doing simulations, but you would like to use them, which of the many simulations should you use? So this bit, for your purposes and for our purpose here in this conference, I would say it's not necessarily better to use a simulation that has more physics, or higher resolution even. So what matters is, does it reproduce the observables that are important for you? Right? And so not just any observations, but specifically the ones you're interested in. So that's what you should ask your colleagues who do simulations. Don't ask, you know, do you include all this physics, or how high is your resolution? You can ask those things too, of course, but you should also ask to see a comparison with the data you care about. Okay, so just some examples of what that calibration means in practice. I picked up two simulation projects that I'm involved in myself as an example, because these have been very clear about what they do for calibration strategy. Eagle uses 25 to 100 megaparsec boxes. Bahamas, which is led by Ian McCarthy, uses 400 megaparsec boxes. Both of them calibrate on the star formation law, using the Kanaker-Schmidt law as the observation to calibrate against. The type 1A rates, now to predict that, you would need to know the binary fraction, the separation, etc. So you have to calibrate on that too. So what we calibrate on is the cosmic supernova 1A rate density. The stellar mass black hole mass relation, you need to calibrate your AGN feedback efficiency in some way to get the black hole masses right. And then we chose to calibrate on the galaxy stellar mass function, because getting that right means stellar mass to halo mass relation is not crazy. And that's a condition for many interesting questions you can ask. Then in Eagle, we found that's not enough, so we also calibrate on the galaxy size mass relation. Whereas in Bahamas, which is not so much focused on galaxies, but more in groups and clusters, it was in cosmology, it was more important to calibrate on the baryon fractions of the clusters. As I'll show later that that's critical. Other groups have their calibration choices too. It's often not completely clear what it was, and I think if you go to a second generation project, it's never clear. These are coming out of ALS. ALS didn't calibrate anything except the star formation law, basically, and the type 1A rate. But if you do a second generation project, then you're going to change some of your physics based on the failures of the first generation. That is in itself a sense of calibration, so it becomes harder to keep track. And everybody wants to do second or third generation, so it's unavoidable that it will be more and more difficult to figure out what is calibration, what is not. Bahamas is not as high profile a project as, for example, Alastra's and Eagle, but I do want to show it to you because I think for many of you in the room, it's actually a more appropriate simulation than, for example, Eagle is. And that's because it's lower resolution, and that's not in itself is an advantage, but the consequence of that is that the calibration is quite easy, and it's easy to do many runs. So, for example, the galaxy mass function can be done very accurately down to 10 to the 10 solar masses. Here's the baryon fractions in groups and clusters, which are also done accurately. So we calibrate to do those two runs. And many other things that come out right as well. But interestingly also, it's useful that we have dozens and dozens of different simulation versions, different cosmologies, many different feedback prescriptions, massive neutrinos. And there's also an extension that David Barnes did last year to much higher mass halos, all the way up to 10 to the 15.5, basically. Okay, but these large volume worms are not the only thing that's useful. It's also been very impressive to see what happened in recent years with zoom simulations, where you do not just zoom of, as I just talked about for clusters, for example, but you zoom all the way from low halo masses to high halo masses. So each zoom is a different simulation, and that way you cover a large dynamic range. And the FIRE project is one example, and NIHAO is another one. And these have done extremely interesting stuff in the recent years, I think. And that, I think, is a different approach, a complementary approach to the large volume runs like Alastra's, Horizon, Massive Black, and MUFASA. So what are the differences? So if you do these zooms, then you maximize the range of halo masses that you can simulate with a certain amount of CPU time. You also maximize the resolution at each mass scale. And I'm sorry, by the way, some of your projects are not on here, but you can shout later. If you do large volume, then you have some other advantages. One is that there's no confusion between trends that you might find that between resolution and mass scale as the cause of those trends. Right? If you do all these different zooms and you see that dwarf galaxies and massive galaxies have different behavior and they form some scaling relation, you may have to worry that that's a resolution effect because the resolution changes between them. So that disadvantage you don't have. The large volumes have obviously much larger numbers of objects, larger range of environments, and that makes it easy to compare to observations. You can do statistical samples and even mimic selection effects. And the stuff in between the galaxies, the intergalactic medium, is then also included. But I think they're both necessary, these approaches. Here's a picture of the latest fire simulations, Fire 2. So here's stellar mass versus halo mass. And you've seen these kind of pictures many times, also at this meeting. And it's amazing how large the dynamic range is, right? In stellar mass, we spend 8 orders of magnitude. Now compare that with Eagle. This is Eagle, the higher resolution Eagle goes maybe to there. Illustrious does something similar. So it's very small dynamic range that you can't compete with that. With Eagle, we've done Apostle. Maybe Carlos will talk about that later. That goes down a little bit, but still, it's not, and that's a zoom in itself of local groups. So that's pretty amazing, but I think when you take plot dimensional quantities here, you do have to be careful because it's hard to see then how accurate things are, right? Because you have so many orders of magnitude. So what's better to plot, I think, is the stellar mass to halo mass ratio versus halo mass, which usually not shown as often, but it is shown here in this paper from Phil Hopkins from 2014, the first fire simulations. And then you do start to see that you have to, these differences are quite large that you have in stellar mass at fixed halo mass. So much larger than the scatter. Right? So you have to worry, is that these kind of differences, are they not so large that if you would do a mass function, if you'd have a big volume, it would look like nothing like the observations. So I'm not accusing anybody in the audience of adhering to this caricature, but I've read it in many papers, and I've heard also some talks. Some people, this is then a bit an exaggeration, but one point of view about these two different methods, zooms versus large volumes, is that the zooms, they do result feedback. They have high resolution, no free parameters, and therefore high predictive power, whereas the large volumes don't resolve anything, do fine-tuning, and don't predict anything. Now, I'm partly responsible for this caricature because I've kind of emphasized this bit, right? But I that was also a bit of a caricature. I like to exaggerate things to make a point. So keep that in mind when you hear me say anything. So let's just investigate this resolve feedback. I think one definition of resolve feedback is that everything is fully resolved. Well, we'll never get there. We heard that yesterday. But another one might be that if we at least can resolve the molecular clouds, then maybe that's good enough. Well, now that actually is now feasible for the tiny dwarf galaxies. And FIRE, for example, has shown amazing results with such high resolution simulation of parsec scale resolution. But these are tiny, right? So you can't really do it for the bigger galaxies. And for those, then, you can't make accurate ab initio predictions. You do still require, in all these simulations, and that will remain true for a long time, subgrid prescriptions. In some sense, it will remain true forever, of course. And the implementation of these subgrid physics is at least as important as the resolution, I would say. Yeah? And there's choices to be made there. And in fact, some of the problems, overcooling is one of the main problems, do not go away if you increase the resolution. One example, suppose you want to resolve an H2 region, and your stellar mass is a fixed fraction of your gas cell size mass. You keep increasing the resolution, you will never resolve an H2 region if you didn't do it at low resolution, because the ratio between stellar mass to gas mass resolution is fixed. And the same thing happens with supernova explosion. If your initial temperature is too low, because you're not dumping enough energy in these gas particles, if that ratio doesn't change, even infinite resolution won't help. Right, so you may actually need to do something quite different, like create sink particles and make more massive star particles. Many important physical processes like radiative transfer and all these simulations are not done explicitly. They're done on a subgrid level. And if you want real predictive power, then you do need numerical convergence, and it needs to be very good. Right, if you want to get observational matches like is now accomplished by some of these big volume simulations, factors over 2 are not acceptable in the convergence. And that looks very, factor 2 looks very small if you do 8 orders of magnitude on one axis. So I already given you a couple of cents, but here's a few more. So obviously we want to get to resolve feedback, but we haven't got there yet. One thing I think that we have to be careful of, if you do a range of zooms from all the way tiny dwarfs to big clusters, that's very useful, but you can't say that they're one and the same model. Right? Different resolutions is effectively different models if you don't have convergence. So if your same code gets the star formation law right when you have one parsec resolution, and then you do a Milky Way galaxy, you can't assume that that would get the star formation law right. It's not the same simulation. And if you go from one generation to the next and you modify the subgrid physics because you weren't happy with the previous results, and even if you don't then tune the parameters of that subgrid model, it's still calibration. And the other thing to keep in mind is that the large volume simulations are much more thoroughly tested because they can be much more thoroughly tested against observations. And I've exaggerated the amount of calibration that's needed, so I want to rectify this now a bit because it's hurting me now, this exaggeration. Here's one example from a paper from Rob Crane, where we plot the mass function in some test simulations that we did, some 25 megaparsec simulations we did when we started Eagle. Now one of these curves is not calibrated at all. This just dumps all the energy that we have independent of any physical conditions. The mass function is actually fit very well. Right? So the reason we need it is because the sizes then are completely too small, size versus mass. And I don't think there's any simulation that I've seen that doesn't calibrate to sizes that actually get the sizes right. Okay, I will show some results that are about how baryons affect dark matter, but I probably won't get to the end, so I will give you a little summary slide of some of the main points in the beginning before I show these results. And the question came up yesterday, I think, what about dark matter-only simulations? So I'm talking about Hydra now, but will they still be useful in the future? I think certainly they will be, but I just have a few of the cons and pros. One of them is already revealed, I see. Okay, what about the cons of dark matter-only simulations? I think Annalisa made this point yesterday. We've seen now that we want high precision, that the baryonic effects are actually already larger than the precision that we want for many things. Right? So the bigger the uncertainties in the dark matter-only simulations, also in the derived from the empirical and semi-analytical model predictions. So we know that we're not doing it right, so why do we want to do it so accurately then? Even the back reaction of the baryons on the dark matter is not small. It's small in the past, but not small going to the future compared to what we want. However, I would say they're very interesting and still to use dark matter-only simulations, and these are some of the things that you might not be as familiar with, the pros. One of them is that the inner dark matter halos actually correlate a lot better with galaxy properties. We've seen this over and over again. Somebody made a comment about this yesterday as well. We've shown this in papers for the galaxy shapes, the spins, the alignments between the large-scale environment and neighboring galaxies. And that's as you would expect, right? Because the stuff that ends up in the halo later on, the outer part, doesn't have much to do with the galaxy that formed earlier. But in dark matter-only simulation, you could use different kind of definitions of halos. You could look at the properties in the inner parts. Another thing is that even though the masses of the halos are affected by baryonic physics, the positions of the halos and the numbers of them are not affected. And the positions are affected of satellites because they are going through a different potential well. But relative to each other, the two-halo term is not really affected, although the masses are. And that's important for the empirical methods, for example. Right? So that means that they can still be useful. And therefore, then, because the positions of these things are not affected, the large-scale clustering of subhalos as a function of number density, as opposed to as a function of mass, is unaffected. But if you correlate with mass instead of other galaxy positions, then you do have a problem. Now finally, and this is something that really interests me, the dark matter-only simulations do capture the initial conditions. They account for the baryonic effect in the initial conditions, except maybe the streaming velocities, but that's probably a small effect in the ground picture of schemes. So they do affect for the initial conditions, so that means that difference in galaxy properties should be traceable to the difference in the dark matter-only properties, unless the whole theory is not deterministic. Now, we've talked about scatter and scaling relations. That scatter is not stochastic typically, right? We can treat it stochastic, but it should be traceable to something. The universe should not be random. So we should be able to trace it also to the dark matter merger history, accretion histories, and everything. And people are trying to do this. This is one of the goals of the empirical models. So just to switch to some results, I'll show you one attempt of us to do this. This is from the Eagle simulation, a paper from Jort Mate. So what we've done here is we've first show you here the scatter in the stellar mass at fixed halo mass, a function of halo mass. But this is now not the halo mass in the Eagle simulation, because that would be the wrong thing to do, right? Suppose you have more baryons in a halo, that might change the halo mass itself, or certainly its properties. So if you really want to understand this scatter in a causal sense, what you have to do is you have to do two simulations, a hydro simulation and a dark matter only simulation that has the same initial conditions. Then you match the individual halos, and then you compare the stellar mass at fixed halo mass with secondary parameters to explain the scatter. So what is shown here is a dark matter only halo mass. And in each of these dark matter only halos, we look at the corresponding halo in the baryonic simulation, measure its stellar mass, and look at the scatter in that stellar mass. And what you can see is, first of all, that it's not constant. It has a funny shape. And this is the transition, basically, between stellar feedback and AGN feedback. Now, whether that's realistic is one thing, but if there's a different feedback channel, it's not strange, perhaps, that you'd get a difference in scatter. We've heard a lot about scatter. I think everybody assumed it was constant, at least in their comments they made to this meeting. But this simulation predicts it's not. Compare this with observationally inferred estimates from group catalogs, from clustering plus lensing, from satellite kinematics, and it's in the same kind of ballpark, but the observations don't go to these low masses. Although I have to ask Rachel how she did that, but she does seem to go a lot lower. Okay, so let's see if we can explain this. So what we did here is we looked at all kinds of dark matter only properties to see if we could reduce the scatter if we measure stellar mass as a function of two parameters or another one than halo mass. So what we've shown here is the same plot, but now we color code the halos by the formation time of the dark matter halo. Concentration gives the same result, basically. And that explains certainly part of the scatter. If you form earlier, you form more stars in the same halo mass. And why might that be? Well, I don't know, but it could be because you have more time to form the stars, or it could be because the halo has a higher binding energy when it's more concentrated, so it's more difficult for feedback to stop the star formation. But at least there is a second parameter, and it's also a parameter that empirical models have considered. However, it doesn't help very much. So here's the scatter that I showed you before. If we also take concentration into account, or formation time, you get these dashed lines. The scatter is a bit reduced, but it's not very much reduced. Most of the scatter is still unexplained. If instead of these two parameters, you use one parameter with a different one, like Vmax, which many empirical models use, you do basically just as well. Or you could instead use the total energy within R2,500, for example, that would also give you the same result. And we did our best. We tried many other things, including accretion over different timescales, but we actually couldn't explain the rest of the scatter. It's not stochastic, because it correlates very well with other baryonic properties, as we'll show in future papers, but we haven't been able to trace it to the dark matter only. That might be indicating that there's numerical noise, or it might be that we haven't been smart enough about the physics that's going on, or maybe the universe really is random.
Can you say a few things about how you stellar mass is defined? You've got all the stars within the very radius or outdoor radius?
No, these are the stellar mass within 30 kpc, 3D radii.
It's always 30 kpc.
Yeah, and this is only centrals in this case. Okay, this is another PhD student from Leiden, Bart Clouwens' paper. He did a few papers testing the technique that observers use to link progenitors and descendants. So one thing you can do is you can rank all the observed galaxies by stellar mass or luminosity, rank the dark matter halos as you do in abundance matching, and then say, I'm going to look at fixed co-moving number density. So I have a sample at redshift 0, now I'm going to look at redshift 2 for the progenitors, and I use the same co-moving number density of halos when ranked by luminosity or stars. So if you do this, you pick some galaxy at redshift 0, and then you look for their progenitors at constant co-moving number density, then the star formation rate versus stellar mass of these progenitors are these pinky points. Now, whereas the true ones are the black points in the Eagle simulation. Now, part of this is that there's merging going on. Peter Baruzzi gave us a prescription how you can correct for merging. If you do that, you get the green points. Then at least you get the median roughly right. What you can see is that the progenitors, however, are mixed back. So there's an enormous amount of scatter that you're missing if you're doing this technique. Right? And this is also pointed out real illustrious by Sarah Wellens. And that's not the only thing. The scatter is not random. It's actually systematically correlated with the galaxy properties. Here's what happens if you split it in terms of active and passive galaxies. So the red are galaxies that at redshift zero are passive, and that's their progenitors, and the blue are the ones that are active at redshift zero. As you might expect, the passive ones, they formed their stars earlier, so they're going to be more massive progenitors at a higher redshift. Right, so these cumulative number density techniques, you have to be careful when you apply them, and I think you really need simulations to test their robustness. Another example here of baryonic effects. Well, the previous one wasn't just baryonic effects, but baryon fraction versus halo mass from Marco Velasic, a previous PhD student at Leiden. And what is shown here is the baryon fraction in a model that doesn't have AGN feedback. By the way, one thing I forgot to mention is that all the Zoom projects don't have AGN feedback yet. It's something. Some of them do. Okay, not the big ones I showed, Nihao and Fire. Okay, so that's what you get then. If you include AGN feedback, and this is from Cosmo Isles, then depending on how you do it, you can get something different. But it's baryon fraction reduction because of feedback shifts to higher masses. And this was shown also for illustrious yesterday. And this effect actually explains much of the large-scale structural differences between baryonic and dark matter-only simulations. For example, the matter power spectrum, the changes in that that are important for cosmic shear, you can explain if you just take this and a Hilbert model. That's the main thing. But it does mean that the halo masses change. And here's just one example of this from these same simulations. The black lines are two different cosmologies. So this is the number density of halos above 10 to the 14 solar masses as a function of redshift. And this is a kind of interesting cosmology difference, Planck versus WMAP7. But these baryonic differences between two feedback prescriptions that bracket the observations are similar. So it's something we should worry about. And something that's not always realized is that this problem doesn't solve by knowing the true masses. Suppose you can measure the mass of clustering using some proxy, which you calibrate using lensing to the true masses. It doesn't help, right? Because the lensing mass is the mass that's affected by the baryons. So you can't still compare that number density to the dark matter only prediction.
Sorry, what's the halo mass?
Above 10 to the 14. If you do this above 10 to the 15, the differences are smaller.
What's the mass definition?
Oh, M200 mean, I think. Yeah, but I would have to check to be sure. Okay, so maybe you can do so. This is from Bahamas, by the way, from Caldwell. This is the fractional difference in the halo mass, and that's the red dashed line as a function of halo mass. So this is a model that fits the observations even better, and you can see here that if you go to the higher halo masses, the effect gets quite small. The AGN feedback is not strong enough. If you can do something else. You can do, say, velocity dispersion. You may say, I'm not going to compare it to the number density of halos in mass space. I can just do an observable directly. The baryon ones themselves, the gas ones, might be quite complicated. Why don't we just do the kinematics of the galaxies? And that's what we tried in this paper. You can see there's still a bias, which I don't understand really why, but it's independent of mass in this case. It's not huge, but it's big enough to be a problem for precision cosmology. Okay, so here's the large-scale clustering at fixed halo mass from Marcel van Dale. This is the difference, the relative difference between a feedback model that this is in reasonable agreement with observations and a dark matter-only simulation as a function of radius. So you get enormous difference in the clustering at fixed up halo mass, but that is mostly because the mass has changed. And so if you correct for that, if you don't do it at the fixed mass scale, but you do it for a fixed set of subhalos, then the large scale effect goes away. Right? So that's what I said, that the positions of the halos are not really changed, except when they're satellites. So that means that the large scale clustering is the same, but on small scales you do get a difference. You get less clustering first when you get to this region where the baryons have been ejected, and then when you have dissipation, where you have cooling, you get too much clustering. So still, if you want to use clustering using dark matter only simulations, so I think you would be okay in a two halo regime on large scales, but once you get to a megaparsec or so, I don't think it's going to work. This is from Chavez Monteiro, who used Eagle to investigate how well SHAM does for clustering. So what he did is he first investigated various ways to define, to rank the halos. You can use the current Vmax, you can use the Vmax at infall, you can the maximum circuit velocity ever, or the maximum ever when it's relaxed. He looked at the two-point correlation function of galaxies of fixed stellar mass bins as a function of radius, and you can see there's quite big differences for any of these. In retrospace, it's easier because then you project bigger distances on smaller scales, so you're less affected. But still, the differences are quite large. Okay, I'll stop with this one, assembly bias. It's there, assembly bias. That's the difference between the curves and this line. It's also there in CHAM, but not quite at the right magnitude. And I have to stop, so I'll tell you finally that you have to really worry about the variable IMF. Another paper from Bart Clowens, because the variable IMF is going to mess up everything, and it's almost unavoidable. Okay, thank you.
Questions? Alex?
At the beginning of your talk, you showed a plot from FIRE, I think, that was comparing the star to halo mass relation. It looked like it was going down to stellar mass of 10 to the 4 and comparing with abundance matching. Does that worry people?
It probably helps if I show the plot. If I can find my cursor. Well, let's do it this way.
Oh.
What worries me? That abundance matching Sloan doesn't go down to galaxy mass of 10 to the 4, so it's a complete extrapolation, and yet these simulations are calibrating to that.
Ah, sorry. I've got a new computer, so I don't know how it works yet.
Taking the extrapolated, which are extrapolated, and maybe other folks will talk about sort of various extrapolations on the lines there.
Yeah.
And then just showing what the simulations get compared to that extrapolation. It's not, I wouldn't read into that too.
Is there no implicit calibration going on at all in that people are looking at this and thinking, okay, this means that simulation is better calibrated? Or, I mean, it is extrapolated from about 10 to the 9 in galaxy mass, right?
I think the more careful comparison you would do is the abundances of those mass galaxies in local group-like environments, which we're going to talk about later in the week. That's where you can test your model. This I would take as more graphically diagnostic, just to put everything on the same plot. Whether or not you believe those extrapolations is, I think, something we'll probably talk about later in the week.
Yeah, I think it's just, I just think we need to be careful making such plots, and you might even consider like stopping the abundance matching lines actually where the data are constraining.
One thing that Till Sawala pointed out is that over here, a lot of halos may be empty, although FIRE gets much less empty halos, so it might be partly resolution effect. But in any case, if there is at some point empty halos, then this inference from observations changes.
So Yopo, on the initial part where you discussed zooms versus large volumes and pros and cons, there's a point that it still worries me a lot about the large volume hydro simulations, and that's the fact that 10 years ago people were doing a lot of tests of numerical convergence. They're taking, isolated galaxy setups, maybe cooling halos, setting up the halo gas and let it cool. And then at least two groups, our group and also the group in Durham, were finding that there were a lot of bad numerical effects until you were getting up to at least 10 to the 5 particles. Mm-hmm. So it was very hard to converge both in angular momentum and even in mass accretion rate in these isolated setups. So at that time, people were saying, yeah, so that means that 10 to the 5 particles is sort of the target that we should aim for in the cosmohydro simulations. Then, many years later, people seem to have forgotten all this work that has been done at the time. And the question comes, a lot of the galaxies in these large volumes, including in Lustris as well, are below that resolution. Now, I agree that you have subgrade physics that will play an important role, maybe washes completely some of these effects. But then the question is, how can you be sure to be predictive if you don't have control on the basic hydrophysics in the simulations?
Well, I agree with that. It's a worry. And we and others do resolution tests with some recalibration or not, so you do have some idea. But yeah, it is a worry. So in many respects, they're not so predictive. In response to Rachel yesterday, I exaggerated a bit and say they're not predictive at all. I think stellar masses, for example, predictive to a factor of a few. But qualitatively, that's how they're predictive, by explanations. You're seeing scenarios in the simulations why something happens. And that's much less sensitive often to the resolution than the exact number. And that's, I think, how we should use them if we can. There are other areas where they're very predictive still. For example, the distribution of hydrogen lime lava forest. That's very well resolved.
Can you expand more on your last point on the IMF? My takeaway from the IMF literature is at least the low mass IMF is variable, but maybe only in extreme environments like the highest, most dense ellipticals or low mass dwarfs. Are you talking about high mass IMF or low mass IMF?
Well, yeah, that's often not clear from depending on the observations, which one. So we're doing various investigations of the IMF simulations, but this paper actually only uses observations. So what we did here is we took the metallicity dependent initial mass function that was inferred from Khalifa observations by Martin Navarro. And what they chose there, so they sensitive to spectral features of dwarfs. And they chose to fit their observations as a function of metallicity with these solid lines. So here's the IMF, right? So this is a varying, basically, the IMF everywhere. We said you can also explain the same observations if you vary only the low mass end, and that's the dashed lines. So we tried both. And what you get here, if you do their IMF variation, is the star formation rate change versus stellar mass change, where each point is an observed galaxy from SDSS. And we've just used the observed mass metallicity relation and all their observations to change their star formation rate and stellar mass. You can see that the stellar mass goes up by large factors, star formation rate goes up by large factors. And it's not just a fixed factor of mass, because they're scattered in a mass metallicity relation. That's why you have different colors, and it's different stellar mass at the same change. So that means it messes up all the abundance matching. Now this is enormous, but we say you can explain the same observations if you change the low mass and IMF, and then the variations are much smaller, the scales here are differently, right? This is three orders of magnitude, this is a factor two. But still, there's changes. Another interesting thing about the change of IMF, by the way, is that Charbonnier minimizes the mass-to-light ratio. Anything you do is coincidence. But anything you do to the IMF will give you more mass. So if you're getting the mass right now, since the universe will definitely not have a Charbonnier IMF, you're underestimating the mass in your models.
You showed this plot of the scatter and the stellar mass halo mass relation that I thought was really cool.
Wave, because I don't see where you are.
Sorry, Benedict. There was this funny wiggle in the scatter plot that you showed, and I was wondering if that is physical or if that's a simulation effect that you understand.
So the wiggle is due to the... happens in the transition between feedback from stars and AGN. Now, I wouldn't claim that the real universe has the same wiggle, because we're doing this quite crudely. But at least that change of slope is not so strange to me. If it's a real wiggle, I don't know. This wiggle depends on what you use as the predictor of your proxy for stellar mass. And so it's much more pronounced if you use the energy within our 2,500 than if you use halo mass, for example.
It didn't seem like the scatter was increasing in the zoomings. The fire plot that you showed, the scatter was not going up.
I don't think we can tell. How does this work?
Andre, you're supposed to talk into the mic.
And I don't think we can tell because this is the regime that we are looking at. Is the scatter different here from there? Who knows? Well, so the observed scatter is 0.1 dex, which is this thickness of this line, basically, right? So that's you can hide a lot of things if you do many orders of magnitude on one axis.
Yao-Yuan Mao, Pittsburgh. Can you elaborate a little bit on the galaxy assembly signal that you see stronger in EGOs than abundance matching? What kind of galaxy assembly bias exactly is that?
The galaxy assembly bias. I can't elaborate very much because I don't know the cause of the difference. But what we did here, I can tell you what we did. So what we did is we measured the correlation function, and then we reshuffled the galaxies in halos at fixed mass, keeping the distance between to the halo center the same, fixed. And we remeasured the correlation function, and then we plot the relative difference as a function of radius. Then what you find is that after reshuffling, you get a different correlation on these scales, and the difference is shown here. So the difference is about 20%. So then you underestimate the correlations by about 20%. If you reshuffle sham applied to this simulation in the same way, then you also get the assembly bias quite similar, but not quite as strong, right? And it doesn't matter that much exactly what your proxy for stellar mass and sham is. You underestimate or you get the clustering difference by about 10% on these scales.
Apply the sham to the simulation itself or the dark matter version?
To the dark matter version. Doesn't really matter.
Mike Cole?
On the question of the metallicity dependent IMF and the variable mass to light ratio, does that actually change the ordering of the masses of galaxies? I mean, is it really a sort of a non-monotonic function that that's involved?
If it depends on what's causing the IMF to change. IMF changes with potential well depth, then maybe we change it because of concentration. If in this case, like it's metallicity, then because there's scatter in a mass metallicity relation, it does change the ordering quite a bit.
But I can imagine many types of variations that would actually preserve the abundance matching technique quite well, even if there were a variation. Now, it would change the actual masses, but it wouldn't change the rank ordering. I mean, many versions of the mass to light ratio variation would do that, would they not?
There are some that would, yeah. But I think metallicity is physically, for example, quite a natural candidate. Why the IMF might be different. Another one might be the radiation field, which depends on the star formation rate. The star formation rate has scatter with respect to stellar mass, and metallicity has scatter with respect to stellar mass. So if it's something that has scatter with stellar mass, then you don't preserve the ranking. So I'd be surprised if the ranking is preserved to the level that we need to do high precision work.
But doesn't it preserve something like the median relation? I mean, it would add additional scatter, but would it really completely scramble the ordering of galaxy masses?
Well, we don't know how strong the IMF varies and what it depends on, so I can't answer that.
But I thought it was something like the IMF, at least the proposed one from Van Dockum and so forth, it changed essentially as you went to larger mass galaxies. Mm-hmm. It seemed to be in a way that would preserve the ordering of the masses of galaxies.
Well, they don't know, because they don't know. They've only measured it with respect to galaxy mass or something. They tried to look for some second-order correlation. I don't think that was very successful. It depends what physically changes the IMF. What has also become clear is that the IMF depends on radius within these galaxies. So it also depends on what you call a galaxy.
Andrew? In your list of pros for using dark matter only simulations, you had a bullet point that said something like galaxy properties correlate well with the inner properties of dark matter halos.
That's right.
And then you have this other part of your presentation where you look at the explanation for the scatter and stellar mass at fixed halo mass, I guess is what you were looking at, and what other properties might explain that. So I'm wondering if you could just elaborate on the relationship between those two statements.
Yes, that's a good question.
Thank you.
Okay, so that was my hope indeed, that we could just, I said, Vmax is an example. Vmax is a measure of something more in the inner part, and it does work better, as you can see. But my hope is that we could find a scale which is ideal. We also try, for example, the core mass, so the mass inside the scale radius of the halo, and that was a total disaster. So you would think that there are some scale, and there clearly Vmax does better, but we haven't found the magic recipe. And I'm not sure if that means there isn't one, as I said, or maybe it's an inadequacy of the simulation. It would be interesting to do this for other simulations, that's for sure. So I hope that the Lustrous, for example, is going to try something similar.
Last question going to Simon. So I think, coming back while you have this plot up, it's very interesting that you couldn't find anything in the dark matter histories which would reduce the scatter. Did you check the baryonic histories? Could you see, for example, whether some of the objects had a particularly strong starburst or an AGN episode or some other activity? Because that might be something that was effectively stochastic as far as the dark matter is concerned.
Yeah, we haven't, we've looked at some baryonic properties. We haven't looked at all of them, but one of our worries is that big AGN explosions, which might be quite stochastic, maybe not in reality, but in the simulations, that could be a reason. However, we can explain, the scatter is not random. It correlates with all kinds of baryonic properties. So it's even in the simulation, it is quite deterministic, but we haven't been able to figure it out. But yeah, it's possible that stochasticity, because of the simulation recipes, is too important.
Okay, so with this, we have to break for coffee. But before that, let's thank Benedikt and Job for excellent talks. And very convenient at 11 o'clock.